So that concludes the hearing on 2005. We now will begin the hearing on Rule Petition 2006. Get my list of players here. Okay, 2006, Attorney Kastner, you are the presenter. Are you prepared to proceed?
I am.
Please do.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. May it please the Court, my name is Jill Kastner. I'm an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin and director of the Student Legal Aid Project, which is part of Legal Action's Volunteer Lawyers Program. I'm here today in my capacity as the immediate past president of the State Bar of Wisconsin to speak in favor of Petition 2006. I'm here with Attorney Dean Dietrich, and we have divided the topics up so that I will focus on how the petition will promote access to justice, as well as the technical corrections and late payment additions. And Attorney Dietrich will focus on the creation of the senior active category and how the petition will ensure that all practicing lawyers take appropriate CLE. Before I delve into the proposed changes, I feel that I need to provide some background as to how the petition came to be. This is particularly true because I often, throughout this entire process, I've heard that horrible mantra, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I want to be clear that, you know, since President Deisinger in 2016, all of the state bar presidents and leadership have agreed it's broken and we need to fix it. And that's why back in 2016, President Fran Deisinger started looking at the various problems with emeritus. And that included the fact that emeritus, if you read the dictionary definition, means retired with honors. And yet our emeritus category is odd in that it includes both attorneys who are fully retired and have been for years, as well as attorneys who are fully practicing and take fees. It is an active membership category. Under the current rules, any attorney age 70 or older can become emeritus simply by asking for that status in writing. And once they are emeritus, they are no longer required to take any CLE, no matter how many years they practice. They are no longer required to pay any dues or court assessments other than the $20 client protection fund. This was becoming a growing problem because emeritus was and is our fastest growing membership category among Wisconsin lawyers. At the time, in 2016, emeritus was about 10% of our active members. If nothing changes, emeritus will soon be 15% of our active membership and rising. President Deisinger's successor, Paul Swanson, appointed the Emeritus Task Force. It was comprised of several former State Bar presidents, a retired Supreme Court justice, current and former presidents of our Senior Lawyers Division, members of our Non-Resident Lawyers Division, and of course, current members of leadership, which included President Chris Rogers, and I also served on the task force. And we were tasked with addressing at least three issues. First, Wisconsin's strong policy that practicing attorneys need to take CLE. And contrary to that policy, there was this growing number of emeritus attorneys who are not required to take CLE. Second was the confusion created. As there were more practicing emeritus attorneys, there was greater confusion as to what emeritus meant. And third was an issue brought to us by our non-resident lawyers division. And that was our inactive members who wanted to retire, to no longer practice law, but they wanted to be emeritus. They wanted to be retired with honors. They were unable to easily transition without jumping through the hoops of taking additional CLE and so forth because emeritus is an active status. And I know we may have the Board of Bar Examiners saying that, you know, that's not particularly onerous, but I've heard from a lot of individuals who've had to go through that process, they feel otherwise. And so this was a concern and causing some people to give up their license. So the task force met, and that very first day, we very quickly agreed to several points. First, emeritus needs to mean retired. It should no longer be an active status. That fixes the problem of confusion, and it fixes the issues our inactive members were having when they wanted to try to retire to emeritus. Second, any lawyer who is practicing and takes a fee must take their CLE. Finally, both emeritus and inactive lawyers should be able to provide pro bono services with our qualified pro bono providers. Now, working out the details to exactly how the petition would be, that took a little more time. The petition you have before you is the result of 3 years of fact-finding, discussion, collaboration, and of course, compromise. It is supported by the State Bar, its non-resident, and its senior lawyers divisions. The proposed revisions are forward-looking and they are fair. So my focus is how the proposed changes can help to improve the number of pro bono attorneys working to increase access to justice in Wisconsin. So as you know, there is a justice gap where low-income residents are unable to obtain the legal assistance that they need. And pro bono providers, such as Wisconsin Judicare, Disability Rights Wisconsin, and of course, Legal Action and others, simply don't have the resources to meet this need. However, with pro bono attorneys, we can help fill the gap. Under the petition, inactive and the newly created emeritus, who would otherwise be retired, can provide pro bono under the supervision of a licensed attorney with one of our qualified pro bono programs, just like the one that I run with Legal Action's Student Legal Aid Project. Now, this is obviously, there are guidelines under which this occurs. It is only for low-income individuals. The qualified pro bono providers, we provide the CLE training CLE approved training, I should say, training manuals, opportunities to shadow experienced lawyers, experts to answer questions, and of course, supervision. Now, before I turn it over to Attorney Dietrich, there are also what we consider to be hope to be pretty non-controversial proposed changes designed to make clear the processes and fees that are already in place, as well as clarifying some technical language. So this includes clarifying the court fees in Section 8 that already exist. In Section 10, we formalize the reinstatement fees and late penalties that are already being imposed. And finally, we change some technical language. So where it says Secretary of the State Bar or Executive Director of the State Bar, we simply say State Bar. I'm not aware of any concerns as to these specific changes, but I am happy to answer any questions the court may have with regards to either these technical changes or with regards to the pro bono portions of the petition.
Is it your preference, Attorney Kastner, and you too, Attorney Dietrich, that we now ask you questions before Attorney Dietrich presents, or do you both want to present, and then we'll ask questions, and you can feel them as you choose? What's your preference going forward?
I'm fine either way.
Either way?
Okay. All right. Well, does anyone have questions they'd like to ask Attorney Kastner at this time? Not that you can't ask her later, you certainly can.
I'll ask a couple of questions. I understand that we require actively practicing attorneys to take CLEs, but this is more of an empirical question. Is there evidence that attorneys who stop taking CLEs and continue to practice after age 70 are committing more ethical lapses?
No. And in fact, it would be difficult for us to track because obviously there are certain lawyers who are over that age but are not emeritus, because not every attorney over age 70 has adopted to take emeritus status. What we have been told anecdotally is that older attorneys, and I don't simply mean emeritus attorneys, but older attorneys tend to have fewer claims, but bigger dollar amount claims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just asked the question because I understand we have sort of a status quo in the way we operate a little bit, but we're talking about adding certain educational requirements under a certain class of people. presumably on the theory that the educational requirements help them to be better practicing attorneys. That may or may not be true. I don't know if that's true. Sometimes more education doesn't always mean you're better at what you do. Sometimes it just means it's time and effort spent. So if any other folks who go after would like to address that question, it's something I'm interested in. So I'm curious from a financial perspective, what is the financial impact on the state bar's budget with the additional dues paying members?
The immediate impact would be nominal, because the only real change would be those after the petition would be passed, those 69, then about half would typically go emeritus, and obviously that half wouldn't. So that's, about 250 times the 200. So, I mean, it's a nominal amount. Now, over time, obviously, it would be a larger amount paying, their court assessments and dues. But the immediate impact would not be, it would be a very small percentage of our budget.
Do you think that it creates a counter incentive here? You know, think about costs and benefits for different changes here. So in some ways, this makes continuing to practice a much more expensive and time-consuming proposition. So those over 70, well, now, if they want to continue to do some legal work, they will, the costs are higher. We've been making the costs higher for them, not just financial costs, but the time costs, both of those things. Do you have any thoughts or comments on that?
Well, I think that it's important to remember that, we as a state have decided that continuing legal education is important, and that we want our practicing attorneys to do so, so that there would be an increased cost. It's not going to be an issue of, as you said, the dues or the court assessments, would be the time, but we think the time educating oneself is important if you do in fact want to continue to practice and continue to take fees. Now, for those for whom the cost is difficult, as a pro bono provider, I would say come join and sign up for some pro bono work, where we can provide your CLEs for free, and even some of your pro bono hours, can be converted into CLE. So there are definite ways in which this would not be a cost prohibitive for members.
Yeah, it may not be prohibitive, but I do have at least some concerns about that. I mean, I think about some of our more rural communities that have already very few lawyers already, many of whom are aging relatively quickly, right? And so say you have somebody who's may not want to practice that much, but may want to do some things, take on some public defender appointments, take on a few cases here and there. This will become a much more expensive and time-consuming proposition for them to continue to do that type of work. And I guess I have some concerns that maybe we might be creating the wrong incentives in certain places through a rule that requires those people who may want to continue, take senior status like federal judges can take, right? I'll take whatever cases I want to take, and I can continue to take cases, but I'll just do what I want to do. That becomes a harder proposition, right? You kind of got to be all in or all out. Again, that everything comes with costs and benefits. I think the reality is that we'll push some people out of practice who would otherwise be in practice and be in part-time. Now, maybe not many, maybe not enough to make a difference. Maybe my concern is negligible and outweighed by other things. But, there's always costs and benefits to the incentive structures you create. This does seem to me at least create that incentive structure for older practicing attorneys to cease practicing because it becomes a much more burdensome proposition.
And I think it was that concern, which was part of the reason why the senior active status was created for those 75 and older. The current emeritus status was created in 1975, when the life expectancy for the majority male attorneys was about 69 years. You know, life expectancy has increased dramatically to over 76 years. And so, by creating that senior active status to those, 75 and over, it allows them to kind of wind down their business, only taking, paying half dues and taking half CLE.
Attorney Kastner, to that point, and I understand the whole idea behind life expectancy, I'm wondering what the typical practice age is in terms of at what point are people done practicing regardless of how long they live? I don't know the answer, but is there a reason you chose 75 for senior active status as opposed to 70 or 72? Or I don't know if there was something that you based that on.
Absolutely. So the task force in looking at that was looking at the difference in the life expectancy numbers between 1975 when it was created and the life expectancy numbers today. We would love to be able to tell you how many of our emeritus members are actively practicing, which ones are kind of, half practicings and which ones are fully retired. But we don't have that data, and we can't get that data, because once you're emeritus, you can practice as much as you want or as little as you want. And there's, none of those requirements.
Any other questions?
Yes, I understand that one of the reasons for bringing this petition is that the committee deemed Wisconsin out of step with other jurisdictions who allow actively practicing emeritus attorneys to continue to practice without taking CLE. I misstated that. Wisconsin does that currently, but other jurisdictions don't. Can you add any additional light to that premise?
Well, certainly. I mean, obviously, there's the ABA model rule, and there are a couple states, a few states that don't require any of their attorneys to take CLE. But of the states that require CLE, the idea of emeritus being an active practice is rare. I think we were only able to find half a dozen other occurrences, and I'm thinking half of those were age 75 and over. And I probably shouldn't give numbers because I don't have the facts in front of me, but I do recall the task force was looking at that information and realized how unique Wisconsin's emeritus was.
Unique in the sense of allowing attorneys to practice law without taking CLE, is that
correct. And basically have there are a number of jurisdictions that allow their emeritus attorneys to, for example, not pay dues, but to not have their emeritus members who practice not take CLE was rare.
Any other question? I want to talk a little bit about the categories, but I don't know if Attorney Dietrich, if that's more in your ballpark or more in Attorney Kastner's ballpark.
I think it probably would fit for me.
For you, okay. So I'll wait till you do your presentation. I also wondered, what about malpractice exposure for the people that are pro bono? Do we have a statute that says if you don't accept or expect a fee, you can't be sued for malpractice?
Not at all. Lawyers can still be sued for malpractice. The good thing, the reason why we didn't say that you could do any pro bono, you can only do pro bono with one of the qualified providers, is all of the qualified pro bono providers have malpractice insurance. Therefore, okay, anyone who takes a pro bono case is covered.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's good to know. All right. Any other questions? Okay, then Attorney Dietrich, will you please begin?
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Dean Dietrich, and I am an attorney in Wausau and previously served as the past president of the Senior Lawyers Division, particularly at the time that this topic was debated and discussed by the task force. My presentation today was to talk about the proposed changes to create the senior inactive or senior active status. But I will prefer to perhaps be more helpful to the court by trying to give some further information in response to the questions from Justice Hagedorn. I will tell you, to speak very candidly, I'm very close to the point in time where this rule will specifically affect me. And I would answer Justice Dallet by saying I have a lot of contact with senior lawyers, lawyers who are looking to transition, lawyers who are struggling with that notion of whether they want to continue to practice or not. We don't have specific numbers, but I have had contact with a lot of different lawyers, some who have surprised me at age 80 are very actively practicing and stating they want to continue practicing. So that has been very much an eye-opener for me in my role as working with senior lawyers. But Justice Hagedorn, all I can start by saying is I spent a lot of sleepless nights trying to wrestle with the tension that you described, the tension between wanting to make sure that we are not causing senior lawyers to stop practicing because of the challenges of CLE. Yet, on the other hand, not only the argument about fairness, but the argument about the appropriateness of lawyers reaching age 70 and not having to take CLE credits when they're still very actively practicing. We did look at age 75 from the perspective of what the actuarial tables told us, but my experiences from a lot of different settings are lawyers are going well beyond the age 70 in their practice with specialization, with the opportunities to work with younger lawyers in firms or being a sole practitioner looking to bring somebody into their firm to run their business down the road. There's a lot of efforts to provide for transitioning of lawyers as they move on into the latter parts of their career. Unfortunately, Justice Hagedorn, I didn't come to a simple answer to some of the tensions that you described. I felt I had a role to be an advocate for senior lawyers in my position as president. And that's what I did. And I worked very hard to try and preserve things for senior lawyers, but at the same time recognize that I really could not answer the question, how is it okay for a lawyer at age 69 to have to take 30 credits of CLE, but a lawyer at age 70 doesn't have to take any? I could not safely, fairly, and comfortably answer that question. As one who participates in a great deal of ethics presentations throughout the course of the year, I can tell you that the ethics programs that are put on are dealing with changes in the rules of professional conduct and the theories of ethics and professional responsibility. And those should apply to all lawyers if they're actively practicing, regardless of their age. So the compromise that was hard fought by many, many people brings us to a point where those who have enjoyed the emeritus status prior to July 1, 2021, or another date as the court may set, would continue to enjoy that status. But going forward, any lawyer at age 75 would be able to continually actively practice with the 15 credits per two-year cycle, three of which must be ethics as compared to 30, and pay half the dues instead of the full dues. That's proposed in recognition of, not always, but for a vast majority, lawyers who have spent a great deal of time in the practice, committed to the bar, participating in the bar, paying dues for the bar, that type of thing. But it also looks forward. The notion of this proposal, number one, is to resolve what has been a conundrum for many years. And number two, to look forward to what really is the right balance for practicing lawyers. What should be the expectation for all practicing lawyers? We could debate for many hours whether or not CLE courses are effective, whether they prevent problems, that type of thing. I know that the end result of that debate would be not a clear question, not a clear answer to that question. But to suggest that there will be a requirement that would apply to all lawyers, acknowledging that age 75, which is acknowledged to be a more commonly recognized transitioning age, if you'll accept those terms, allowing them to do the transition with that in mind, I think actually will help those older lawyers stay involved in the practice. The one other thing I would advise the court of is that the Senior Lawyers Division is working very hard to develop a library of programs and a publication of a number of programs that would qualify for CLE credits, that if you're a member of the Senior Lawyers Division, you can take those credits without having to pay a fee. So we recognized the issue of cost, and we recognized the importance of trying to assist lawyers with that cost issue. You raised, though, Justice Hagedorn, the other thing we debated a lot, which is the time. It's not just the cost of CLE. It's the time commitment to get the courses. Zoom right now maybe makes that a little easier, but we can't rely upon that forever. And there should be live in-person programs. But where we finally reached a conclusion on that point is, it is a privilege to be a lawyer. It is part of our responsibilities to competently and diligently represent our clients, whether we're age 40, whether we're age 55, whether we're age 75. And using that as a backdrop, to establish some requirements and to work with senior lawyers to make those CLE credits available, I think is the way to look forward properly, fairly, and appropriately for preserving the practice. Now, I know there's some questions about the different categories that would be created. It is my view that the only category that is really being created is the senior active category, which really is the same as active. So the same systems are to be followed, the same procedures are to be followed, but the amounts of CLE credits to be earned is at a different amount. Emeritus lawyers and inactive lawyers would be the same. The proper use, as past President Kastner has discussed, of the concept of emeritus really fits with the common understanding of that language when we look at emeritus professors in the university system and things of that nature. So we think that the inactive or the emeritus will be the same, will be tracked by the state bar, and should not create an additional administrative burden. So Justice Hagedorn, I thank you for raising the question, because it truly was an anguishing question that I had to deal with, because I felt I was the advocate for the senior lawyers in the state bar. And this compromise, as I said, was worked on very diligently by many people. The notion of those who already are emeritus continuing to be emeritus under those conditions is part of the, shall we say, compromise that we discussed in reaching this proposal to present to the court. And I would request that the court adopt these changes, because I think it is a forward-looking way to address this issue for Wisconsin lawyers.
Thank you. Are there questions for Attorney Dietrich?
Chief Justice, I have a question, and I'm not actually sure if it should go to Attorney Kastner or Attorney Dietrich, so I will toss it out there. And it has to do more with what Attorney Kastner said. Thank you both for being here today. I appreciate it. Attorney Kastner, you started out really talking about access to justice and how this would help people who don't have access to justice currently gain more access, because it would increase the number of attorneys that would be available to help people gain access to the legal system who may not otherwise be able to have access to it. I think that the cost-benefit analysis goes both ways. I think Justice Hagedorn brings up some good points about the cost to the individual attorneys, but I also think that can possibly is balanced out by helping individuals who wouldn't have the capability or the ability to pay for attorneys in the legal system. I don't know if you're able to do this, but I'm curious as to if you have any idea as to the numbers. How many more attorneys would we have a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, who might be able to perform the important work of giving access to justice for people who might not have it otherwise?
Absolutely. And the biggest addition there is going to be in our inactive members. Right now we have nearly 500 inactive members who under this petition would now be able, if they were willing, provide pro bono services for our qualified pro bono providers. So that would be 500 just in the inactive status. And obviously that's a growing category as well. And then that would be the biggest chunk right there. Right now, providers are, because of technology, we have remote, virtual legal clinics. We do a lot of, virtual representation. If this pandemic is good for anything, or if there's, a silver lining on it, it's the fact that we've learned to use these virtual technologies, and we have been, in order to provide justice and, utilizing, states that are active members in Wisconsin, but who are located out of state, you know, and so they're able to provide pro bono services here in Wisconsin. We've been doing that with law students who are out of state as well. Obviously, they're not providing advice, but they can still do legal research, drafting, you know, other important work for our pro bono providers. And they can do that from no matter what state that they're in, no matter what law school that they're going to. So this will increase the number of those eligible to do pro bono in Wisconsin. And, you know, as, you know, part of legal action, you know, I'm eager to make those pushes.
Thank you.
The new emeritus class you have, which wouldn't include anybody who's 70 and has already taken emeritus status, you also show them as additional pro bono providers, correct?
They could, absolutely.
Yeah.
But they can do anything else they want to do as well, correct?
Right.
Okay, all right, just to be sure. Any other questions?
Just to follow up on the logistics of this here. So is there a reason, maybe it's financial, but why we wouldn't just start the new senior status at 70 still? There are people who might want to, again, go to a shorter time period, you know, or go to a more part-time-ish practice at a slightly earlier age. You know, so the incentive structure here is until you hit 75, you know, you need to follow the full time lawyer kind of requirements. But there may be people who would like to wind down their practice earlier than, say, 75. Is there a reason you guys chose the number you did, pushing it back to 75, other than, and obviously there's a financial incentive for the state bar that's there, but any other policy reasons that might suggest that makes sense?
The reason that we looked at 75 was primarily to recognize what we think is more of the operational decisions that people are making, that there are many more people actively practicing in that 65 to 70 to 75 range. It really wasn't a financial consideration, because currently those who are at age 70 in the emeritus status aren't paying any dues. So it really wasn't, that wasn't the turning point on that, to try and, quote, get full dues. It really was a recognition of fairness for practitioners, those under that age. The age of 70, what I experience is people at age 55 think, yes, I want to be out the door at 70. I want to be retired, and I want to be doing other things in life. And when they get to age 68, they all of a sudden realize that, well, maybe I want to stay at this longer. Maybe I want to do this some more. Or maybe I just don't know how to transition. And we do a program every year about that. But it really was designed, our choice was to look at what the actuarial stuff suggested was really, when we chose age 70 back in 79, we were just trying to translate it to 2020.
Yeah, no, that's true. I understand that. And I understand, obviously, immediate wouldn't make an impact. Obviously, it does a few years from now, right? I mean, somebody who's 73 pays full dues versus none under the current regime. Yeah. So, you know, if I'm 72 and I'd like to wind down my practice and move to, you know, practicing 10 to 15 hours a week, still keeping up because, as you said, Attorney Dietrich, maybe I still enjoy what I do, but I'd also like to do some other things at this stage of my life. The costs are quite a bit higher if I want to do that. You know, I don't have the window of opportunity for me to take advantage of the reduced bar dues and the reduced CLE requirements to begin to wind down my practice. Obviously, don't kick in for several more years. So there still is that a time frame when it's true many people do practice full time. You know, that's one side of the coin to, you know, far greater years than in the past because we're living longer and health considerations and all those sorts of things. But there are also lots and lots and lots of people who would like to begin to wind down their careers earlier than 75, who might be disincentivized under the structure of the proposed rule from doing so.
It is true that, you know, somebody who wishes to keep active, but at a lesser rate, other than the pro bono work, you know, would have to continue to take the full CLEs until age 75. But it again is trying to address what we felt we could address from a realistic view of what the numbers are, you know, a compromise on that is something that certainly has some merit as well.
Attorney Dietrich, if you wanted to, you know, not practice, you could easily do that at any time, except you could take pro bono, right? You could just go into the inactive status.
Under the new proposal, that's correct.
Okay. Currently, you have to stay fully engaged and take full CLEs up to 70, right?
Correct. That's correct.
So the new status lets you go half-time at 55, if you want to go half-time at 55, right?
You could reduce your workload at 55, but you would still have to take full credits.
But if you reduce your workload to just decide you're going to give back to the legal profession and do pro bono,
that's correct.
Then you don't have that problem.
That is correct.
Okay. That's so correct. What it does is it really encourages participation in pro bono work for those people that don't want to keep going full time. Now, of course, it depends on what they did in private practice. All private practices are not easily transitioned into pro bono service, that I realize.
That's correct. But I can also tell this court that talking with senior lawyers in my role as president of senior lawyer division and talking about transitioning, there is a lot of interest in giving back. Lawyers talk to me a lot about giving back to the profession by doing pro bono type of work or working in a clinic setting and that type of thing. It depends somewhat on their practice.
Okay. All right.
I do just have one other kind of policy question here. I understand that, you know, we as a society often do things to help take care of the elderly poor, Social Security, Medicare, and those sorts of things. But also, lawyers who practice for 50 years might be quite wealthy. and there's a certain amount of generational wealth transfer and bearing the burden that can happen with those things too. So, you know, we have a young lawyer with $150,000 of law school debt who goes and joins the DA's office, and makes $52,000 a year and pays full bore. And you have an attorney who retires from a law firm with their, you know, a seven-figure retirement sitting there, you know, but still wants to practice, or, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank, and we give them a half discount. I don't know what the demographics of our 72-year-old lawyers are. I'm sure there are plenty. There are some who are poor, but my guess is they also tend to be, on the whole, quite a bit richer than their younger counterparts who are paying full price. So any thoughts, comments on that?
Yes, thank you, Justice. You again identify that tension. And as I stated before, I wasn't personally able to resolve that tension. You can think of that lawyer at age 72 or at age 75 who can't, frankly, just simply stated, can afford to take the CLE credits and is willing to take and pay for the CLE credits. I will suggest to you for that lawyer, it may be easier to say this because they would have funds, but typically that lawyer wants to take the credits because they know that's what they should be doing in order to be an effective practitioner. But on the other hand, I talk a lot, again, with those small town lawyers, those sole practitioners, two lawyers, or, you know, two lawyers in a firm, and they're trying to hire in a young associate. It's hard to get that associate to come up to their neck of the woods. They're the ones actually that are concerned about the time commitment to going to a CLE program because of their need to be working in order to keep the office open. So unfortunately, the answer to the comment is it very much depends from which side of the fence you're looking at the question, because there are both sides to it. And in the end, the senior lawyers division felt that this compromise, which tried to address a number of different pressure points, was the best we could do.
Are there other questions for Attorney Dietrich? Okay, thank you. And I think we will move on to our next presenter, Jacqueline Rothstein, Director of the Board of Bar Examiners.
Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of pending Supreme Court Rule Petition 20-06 regarding the emeritus status and the related continuing CLE requirements. Currently, at age 70, attorneys may elect the emeritus status, which enables them to continue to practice law, but does not require them to take or report any continuing legal education to the Board of Bar Examiners. This provision has been administered without incident by the BBE since 1977, and we believe that it should remain unchanged. Nevertheless, the State Bar has proposed a new classification system under which multiple tiers would be created. Within that proposed system, four tiers would exist. First would be those who currently hold the emeritus status and would be allowed to remain in that status under a grandparent provision. Nothing would change for that group of attorneys. They would be able to continue to actively practice law without any restrictions, and they would not be required to take or to report any continuing legal education to the BBE. The second tier would be the new emeritus status. In that tier, attorneys age 70 and older could choose to become emeritus members, but unlike those who currently hold that status, they would not be eligible to practice law except for qualified pro bono matters. While these so-called new emeritus members could not generally practice law, they could, if they chose to, provide pro bono services without having to take or complete any CLE credits. The third tier of membership includes attorneys age 70 up to age 75. Those in that tier who wish to continue practicing law would now be required to take and complete 30 credits of CLE. They would be classified as active members and would have to report their CLE credits to the BBE every 2 years. The fourth and final tier is called a senior active. That tier would include attorneys age 75 and older. Those attorneys would be required to take and complete 15 CLE credits every 2 years and report that information to the BBE if they wanted to fully practice. Whether providing legal services for free or for a fee, the BBE maintains that it is internally inconsistent to require age-based CLE for one group, but not for other ones. It creates a new and cumbersome tiered classification system, which would be both difficult to administer, internally inconsistent, and confusing to the general public and to the bar. There would be attorneys age 70 and older who could practice without taking or reporting any CLE, meaning those grandfathered in. There would be another group age 70 and older who could not practice law except for qualified pro bono matters, but still wouldn't have to take any CLE. There would be yet another group age 70 and older who could practice without restriction, provided they took the 30 credits of CLE every 2 years. And finally, there would be still a fourth group age 75 and older who would have to complete 15 credits every 2 years if they wanted to continue to actively practice. Each tier would have different CLE requirements ranging from none all the way up to 30, making it difficult and confusing to track, which is one reason why the board does not support the proposed changes to the existing rule. Additionally, there is no evidence to suggest that the present system has resulted in increased complaints to or disciplined by the Office of Lawyer Regulation. The rationale for this new classification system is without a sound foundation and appears to be arbitrary in its application. To explain why a 70-year-old might need no credit to practice, while a 71-year-old would need 30 credits, and a 75-year-old 15 credits, would be difficult and convoluted at best. I also want to point out that for those individuals interested in being inactive members, you would not need to take and complete any CLE under this proposal in order to do pro bono work. However, should the court be persuaded that a change is needed, any such modification to the existing system should be equitable and consistent and should include a uniform trigger date for both the emeritus status and the CLE requirements. Having a uniform trigger date for both elements would avert confusion within the bar and for the public at large. It would also eliminate the administrative difficulties associated with tracking multiple tiers of CLE requirements and promote a uniform understanding among consumers and the bar alike. While the board is sympathetic to the changing demographics of the bar, it nevertheless urges the court to leave the existing CLE structure intact. I would be pleased to address any questions that you may have about this petition, and I thank you.
Will you explain what you mean by a uniform trigger date? You're saying like 5 years from now, because some people are already emeritus, and why couldn't we grandfather people in?
No, but by that, Justice Down, I mean a uniform age at which the emeritus status is triggered.
Okay, but you acknowledge, don't you, that certain just age doesn't dictate what someone wants to do in terms of practice or not practice, right? I mean, there's people who want to retire early and people who want to keep practicing. Why should age be a necessary trigger?
Well, the implication here is that age triggers various things currently. So well, 70 is the trigger date. And what we're saying is if you're going to change it, make it a date certain. Don't have one trigger for 70, one for 75.
Well, the idea I think behind what I hear is that we want to acknowledge that people want to practice longer and we want to give them some type of, we acknowledge that they're practicing longer, but maybe not in as full of a capacity. Don't you think that's really the case? If people take time to wind down, that we don't just have a date by which everything comes to a halt?
Well, we would just ask that it remains similar to what it currently is. So instead of, as Justice Hagedorn pointed out, why 75 versus 70?
And then the other question I had is, do you acknowledge maybe that the benefit in terms of the pro bono aspect here, that being able to allow people to practice even when they're not active under the supervision of a pro bono entity would hopefully increase our ability to serve in terms of access to justice?
I always know that is the hope. I don't know if that is the actual reality.
Okay. Well, all right. Understood.
I mean, just as an example, the the CLE rules were changed within the last roughly 5 years to allow people to use pro bono service credit hours towards their CLE practice requirement or their CLE reporting requirement. And we have not seen a huge increase in the numbers in that particular category. So to be candid, I don't know that we would expect to see a large increase in the number of people wanting to do more pro bono as a result of this proposal. I mean, it's theoretically possible. I certainly acknowledge that, but there's no way to guarantee it.
Any other questions?
Yes, thank you. There is an administrative component to this petition, and certainly the BBE is at the center of that administrative component. And then there's a substantive component. And let me tell you how I generally view this substantive component, because it's at odds with what you're saying. And I tell you this to give you an opportunity to inform me why I am wrong, okay? This court was presented with an emeritus petition that did some of this, let me use a legal term, some of this stuff back in 2014. The court rejected it. And then a study committee was appointed shortly thereafter. Now, I would guess that maybe the study committee morning, noon, and night in the last 5 years hasn't been working. But, you know, the committee has been working on this for quite some time. Then I have the Board of Governors, by the requisite vote, which is more than just a majority, have asked this court to adopt the product of the study committee. We put this out for public comment, and most of the comments, I think maybe save two, were in support of this. So this is what my mindset is that I'm asking you to inform. I say to myself, look, the lawyers have studied this, their organization, the Board of Governors is on board with this, the public comment, there's not much against it. So if this is what they want, if this is what they think after 5 years of study, do I know better than this committee of 5 years of study? Do I know better than the Board of Governors? After all, this is the Board of Governors and State Bar of Wisconsin's bread and butter. For me, it's, I don't want to minimize this, but it's another file. And then we're going to discussing some cases after that. I mean, this isn't my bread and butter. This is theirs. And this is the best product they've come up with in 5 years and on this issue. And it has a lot of buy-in. So why shouldn't I just say, pretty much approved. And if it falls down, then you better come back in and correct it because it's on your shoulders, State Bar. So that's my mindset. Tell me where I'm wrong with regard to the substance, not the administration, but the substance of it.
The substance of the proposal, in other words, requiring a tiered system of...
Yes, that's right. Just as has been set out and you previously set out, the difference between the new emeritus and the new senior active and the active up to 75 and the inactive, you know, up to 75. This is what their best product is. And I say... substantively, okay. Now, maybe administratively, it's a nightmare and the answer should be no. But substantively, I, in essence, give great accord to what the profession is asking for us. So what's wrong with my approach in giving them some deference for their years of study and the fact that this is their livelihood and they discussed it and their elected representatives are behind it and so what's wrong with my, you know, tell me, say, Justice Bradley, boy, you're wrong. You can say that. Just kind of say it with a smile, if you don't mind, and then I won't be too offended. No, what's wrong with that approach?
Well, Well, I don't know that there's anything inherently wrong with that approach, other than I do think that there are some internal inconsistencies with it. So, for instance, if the primary premise upon which this is based is that CLE is important and that everybody ought to take CLE in order to actively practice law, then everybody ought to take CLE in order to practice law. And the proposal you have before you does not fundamentally do that. What this does, it allows some people to take a little bit, some people to take none of it. So if what you're saying is fundamentally, it's really important to encourage people to take and provide pro bono services, that's a laudable goal. Few, if any, would disagree with it, certainly. But if it's that critically important, then shouldn't the attorneys who are providing those services be required to take and complete CLE?
I totally agree with you on that in principle. Look, if my hairdresser is required to take CLE, certainly someone practice handling legal matters. If my plumber is required to continue with CLE, certainly for regardless of pro bono or not paying clients, shouldn't they be consistently in principle as you're advancing? But then I say to myself, look, none of this is perfect. And maybe the best we can do to enhance access to justice is this kind of proposal. Turning it down likely in the minds of the protagonists for this proposal, and I think they might be right, you know, will diminish the ability of pro bono services that this rule, imperfect as it is, because of the very reason you say, it's imperfect, but maybe it's as good as we can do under the circumstances. After all, previously we had petitions for a civil Gideon. You know, that's perfect, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I suppose Justice Bradley, if you want to increase access to justice, then why not let all emeritus members be eligible to do pro bono work? And leave and just add that as a new feature.
And that's a real valid response. It's a matter, I think, in my mind, of compromise, you know.
I suspect, I wasn't directly involved with this group, but I suspect that there were a lot of compromises made. And that's why you see this tiered approach, because that's a compromise that was ultimately struck. But I think in striking the compromise, you get disparate impacts without a lot of internal logic. And so from an administrative point of view, as you point out, it is problematic. It does create headaches.
It seems to me that you're arguing two things, that one, this is internally inconsistent. And I think any set of criteria we could find internal inconsistencies with. But your first complaint is that this is difficult to administer. And I just want to ask you some questions about that, because it was your chart really crystallized how simple this is to administer. When you lay out your chart and you look at the first row that you have, the existing emeritus, that is going to be phased out. So while you have four categories right now, you're only going to have three in the not too distant future. So now we're just talking about three categories. And I know at the Board of Bar Examiners, you guys have to keep track of a lot of different things. I mean, certainly you have the capabilities to keep track of only three categories. When I think of what we keep track of in the court system with CCAP or even our case management system, or even my clerk keeping track of the things that we have to keep track of. I mean, it's just so much easier to do today than it was 10, 20 years ago. So I guess I'm having a hard time understanding why three categories presents such a conundrum.
We would first of all have to, and now we're starting to get down into the weeds a little bit, but certainly this would require us to modify our reporting system, because our reporting system cannot currently address these different categories, because our current system is designed to address active attorneys, inactive attorneys, and emeritus members. And so we would definitely have to change that. And there would be a period, you're right. I mean, the emeritus status would eventually change, if you will.
Yeah, look, I get the administrative headaches, but it just seems to me that that while we should consider that, I have a hard time seeing how that outweighs the potential to get attorneys to people. First of all, to allow people to practice longer if they would like to, and also just to increase. I mean, I'm really, really struck by the 500 lawyers that potentially, I get that's the high watermark, that could be performing pro bono work. It just seems to me that even if that creates an administrative headache, that we shouldn't let the administrative headache handcuff the ability of many, many people in the state who aren't able to get representation, the ability to get it.
Well, I'm not sure how they're handcuffed currently from doing that, though. I'm not entirely clear, other than maybe the inactive members in this proposal. I'm really not clear how the current system impairs people from being able to provide those services. I mean, admittedly, if you're on inactive status currently, you're not eligible to practice law in any form. You would have to take and complete whatever CLE you needed to in order to be eligible to provide pro bono services. But you know, subtracting that out of the equation, I'm not sure how we're fundamentally impeding people from providing those services under the existing system.
Attorney Rothstein, if I understand you're opposed to the proposal, if you were to take this as a starting point and you could make any two changes to this proposal that you think would improve it, what would those be?
I guess I'd consider, tweaking the existing system. So in other words, if you want to say, if 70 is too young for emeritus status and you want to bump it up to 72, make it 72, make everybody take and complete the credits. I mean, I would prefer to see an all or none system. I mean, either take CLE credits, if that's really fundamentally critical, and raise the age if the demographics are such that the revenue needs to be increased, for just as an example. And then it would be uniform and it wouldn't be particularly confusing. If you really think that inactive members ought to be able to do CLE, I mean, to do pro bono work, well, so be it. But I have to keep emphasizing that if you allow them to do that, they're not going to be required to take and complete any CLE. And that brings me full circle to the internal inconsistencies. If it's important for attorneys to maintain their educational requirements, but you're not allowing some of them to do that, or you're not requiring some of them to do that, then to my mind, you're creating different categories of attorneys and what's required of each. And why should people who are providing pro bono services not be required to take CLE? Shouldn't they be competent in those practice areas, arguably?
So is the thrust of your position that if somebody is practicing law to any extent, even if it's restricted to pro bono practice, that they should be required to take CLE courses, and they should be required to take them to the same extent as a fully actively practicing attorney. So in other words, you'd rather have the same CLE requirements for everybody, regardless of age and regardless of their status with the state bar if they're practicing law.
Yes, yes, I think that's right. Unless you want to carve out a, you know, if access to justice is really the issue, then I suppose what you could do is carve out an exception that says, you know, you don't have to have an active license if you want to provide pro bono services under a qualified provider, but you do need to take and complete the CLE. And that's another possibility.
One thing I don't think we've talked about, and I don't know if anybody who's presenting to us today is able to answer the question, but has anyone looked into the timing for any changes in coding requirements to adjust the system administratively to reflect any changes that the court might make? Yes, Chief Justice.
I already have. I talked to Jean Bisquette a long time ago, and when we get in conference, I'll send you her communication back to me to my questions on administration and so forth.
Thank you. Everyone else is off the hook.
Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Director Rothstein. Do either of the presenters have one last shot they want to give before I conclude the hearing?
What I did want to clarify one thing, Justice Karofsky, I think I answered your earlier question about the number of inactive members incorrectly. I think I may have accidentally said about 500. It's about 5,000. So I do apologize for that. And then the other remark I did want to make is that there, the concerns raised by Attorney Rothstein are very similar to items that we discussed at length with the task force. And the big reason why it was decided not to create a pro bono, not to create a CLE requirement for those conducting pro bono is because we didn't want to create a barrier. But in order to have those protections, that's why we said it has to be with not just any pro bono, it has to be with one of those certified pro bono providers, one of the qualified pro bono providers who have that malpractice insurance. And frankly, we are very accustomed to training lawyers to do the work and supervising the work that they do to ensure that there is not malpractice committed. So we are confident in our ability to supervise those taking pro bono cases, to train them as they need to be trained. And we didn't want an additional burden to be created for them, a barrier that might prevent them from doing pro bono.
Chief Justice, may I ask a follow-up question?
Oh, sure. You can ask whatever you want. I didn't mean to shut the hearing down. I just thought if y'all were done asking questions, I would do that. But yes.
I just wanted to ask Attorney Kastner to respond, if I could, to Attorney Rothstein's statement that, look, if you wanted to have pro bono attorneys helping to help improve access to justice, you could do that right now. We don't have to change the system.
And that is not correct in regards to the 5,000 inactive members. They are currently not authorized to practice any form of law in the state of Wisconsin. Therefore, they could not provide free legal services in, you know, to our Wisconsinites who are low income. So that's simply not permitted under the current rules. This petition would change that and gives us the potential for 5,000 or more additional pro bono attorneys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Dietrich, you look like you had something you wanted to say before.
No, oops.
You're still muted. Try again.
No, I'm fine. Okay. I just was going to have Past President Kastner respond.
Okay, good. Anything else? Okay, well, that's one of the joys of Zoom, actually, because I know who's going to be speaking. Sometimes I don't when we have rule hearings. So I will conclude this hearing now, and the court will meet in closed conference at, how about 25, is 20 minutes long enough? 25 minutes to 4? Okay, that's what we'll do. So we'll meet in closed conference at 25 to 4. Julie, you can join us, I hope. Very good. Okay. So this hearing is concluded, and thank you all.
Thank you.